Scripture lesson this morning, as we've heard bits and pieces of it already, comes to us from Luke's Gospel, chapter 6. I'll begin in verse 27, read through verse 38. But I say to you who are willing to hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on the cheek, offer the other one as well. If someone takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt either. Give to everyone who asks, and don't demand your things back from those who take them. Treat people in the same way that you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, why should you be commended? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, why should you be commended? Even sinners do that. If you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, why should you be commended? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be paid back in full. Instead, love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. If you do, you will have a great reward. You will be acting the way children of the Most High act, for God is kind to the ungrateful and wicked people. Be compassionate, just as God is compassionate. Do not judge, and you won't be judged. Don't condemn, and you won't be condemned. Forgive, and you'll be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good portion, packed down, firmly shaken, and overflowing, will fall into your lap. The portion you give will determine the portion you receive in return. Here ends this reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. When we hear Jesus say, love your enemies, many of us are like five-year-olds taking in our parents' impassioned lecture on why we should eat all of our vegetables. Think about it. No matter their nutritional value, no matter how many times our parents told us of all the health benefits, no matter how they might help us grow or develop, satisfy our appetites, or do wonders for our antioxidant levels. Maybe that's a stretch, I don't know. Many of us were not interested at some point or another in our journey in consuming these vitamin-enriched, cancer-fighting wonders called vegetables when we were younger. Word has it, there are still a few adults in most congregations who have cheated death up till this very day, only eating vegetables begrudgingly, if at all, in some extreme cases. Now, all of this illuminates the stinging truth that many times human beings would rather do what we want instead of doing what we need. Our bodies need the nutrition vegetable supply. But for those whose taste buds are not tingling with excitement over vegetables, their minds may prevent them from wanting vegetables for fear of how they might taste and perhaps whether or not they would survive. Jesus is focusing on true needs, not wants, here in this teaching, but with another kind of nutrition, soul nutrition. S-O-U-L. Soul nutrition. Nutrition within the deepest parts of a human being. Now, I would be willing to wager a year's supply of Brussels sprouts that none of you, not a single one, woke up this morning with a start, energy infused, sat straight up in bed with unbridled enthusiasm and exclaimed, oh, I can hardly wait to get to church. I do hope and pray that Reverend Wheeler will challenge us at church today to love our enemies. Oh, how I hope and pray he will do that. I'm so excited at the possibility he could do this. I can hardly stand it. Probably if you said that, you would also follow it up by saying, you know, I'm also thinking about having a pile of raw rutabagas for breakfast. Would anyone else like some? Now let's look at this text for what it is. This is a ridiculous teaching that Jesus offered to his closest followers, the disciples. Anyone else who might have overheard it would have probably laughed out loud. This is a clarion call to go against the grain. It's a clarion call to swim upstream and do something radically different than the way most people behave. This is a call to ask Jesus' disciples to break with conventional behavior, to stand out, to stand up, and to find fulfillment in going a second mile, a third mile, a 77th mile. So when I ask us to consider how we might live out this teaching, I'm well aware of the looks that many of you are too polite to give me right now, but you're thinking these looks. I know it. Some of you, you're giving me Southern Hospitality Special, as I like to call it. At church, you smile. But when you get home, you'll say, well, bless his heart. That Reverend Wheeler sure gave it a go anyway. He was so cute the way he looked at us and actually expected us to love our enemies. You know something? Admitting enemies, that we have them, by the way, is actually the first step before we can properly love them. We have enemies, don't we? Some are specific. We know their names. We know their faces. We remember almost word for word the last thing they said to us that made our skin crawl or our blood to boil. Others of our enemies, they live far away. Still others, they live close by, and we can hardly avoid them. Some of our enemies are less specific. And when I say less specific here, I'm talking about cultural enemies. Do we have those? It's easy to keep these kinds of cultural enemy rivalries going because we never let ourselves really get close enough to have actual deep personal conversations with our cultural enemies. We prefer to get angry with them from a distance, and especially on social media, I've noticed. It's easy from afar to say, well, those crazy liberals, well, those right-wing nut jobs, those fascists, those socialists, we cannot stand the thought of them because what they represent is everything we detest. We know these types of attitudes are not becoming of ourselves. We know this is not good for us to hang on to these varying kinds of bitternesses and enemies. Because even on our worst day, we lie in wait seeking revenge. But on our best, we walk around kind of angry. Choosing the path of letting go and responding proactively instead of reactively to our enemies in the face of some truly awful behavior, quite frankly, it is like a pile of vegetables sitting right underneath the nose of a child who hates to eat vegetables because they don't taste good to them. They don't want to do it. We don't want to love our enemies. And yet, it is exactly what we need. Now, first, I want to add the disclaimer that I do not believe Jesus was advocating that any of us should stay in an abusive relationship or situation. Not all situations can be salvaged. For some of us, we need to get up and to get out of these abusive situations to separate ourselves as quickly as possible from abusers. I think it's safe to say here that Jesus was talking about relationships with enemies, not those who should be close allies like our close friends or families, but those who really have no need to be. I don't believe Jesus was making the case that anyone should ignore abuse or make themselves subject to abuse in hopes that taking literal punches or some kind of actual abuse could bring a better outcome. This is a teaching. He's using hyperbole. Now, with that said, I also do not believe that simply being annoyed by someone or disagreeing with a viewpoint they may have or with their behavior or even getting affected in some way by another person's bad choices or even evil behavior is necessarily grounds to write off that person either. Many believe that Jesus' teachings here are the foundation for what came to be called through the years and especially in the civil rights movement, nonviolent resistance. Now, choosing a nonviolent response or way to resist a violent word or act can have some very transforming results. Now today I want to spend the next few minutes talking about how finding this inner strength, this inner determination, and the grace within us to respond to our enemies in nonviolent, non-reactive, but rather proactive, constructive ways can transform not only us, not only our enemies, but perhaps even the world in which we live. You see, when we refuse to return evil for evil, we set ourselves free to chart a proactive, positive course. When we merely react to what others do to us or what we see happening around us, we're bound to stay reactive all of the time, almost in a frantic sort of way of life. When we react without taking the time to pray or to think through our own possible actions or reactions, to wrestle with what it is we're truly feeling, to pinpoint exactly why it is we're hurting, we are often emotional, we are often short-sighted, and we're often prone to say and do things that will actually make the thing worse, and we will regret it. Many of us don't know how to do anything but react emotionally, because this is all that has been modeled for us by our own families of origin. No elbows out there if you're sitting next to family. But what if some of us decide today and moving forward, what if today is the day we draw the line in the sand, even if we've done it before, and we decide that moving forward, we're not going to be controlled only by our emotions in this endless cycle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? What if we decided today was the day, moving forward, once again, no matter how many times we've tried and failed before, that we're done participating in this toxic cycle and wasting all of this energy that becomes negative and all of the drama that goes with it? I wonder what would happen as our children and our grandchildren began to notice that we were living life by the rhythm of grace instead of the drumbeat of revenge. Charting a proactive course for the ways that we live in relationship to our enemies and the ways that we think about conflict internally could potentially change the entire course, not only of our own lives, but of the lives of generations to come after us. The energy we could save on negative emotional squabbling could be used to redirect conflict and break this cycle of retribution. Instead of saying, "Well, that sounds good, but I could never do it perfectly, so I'm not going to even try." Just imagine if we improved by 20 or 30% of the time in our relationships when someone hurt us instead of reacting and hurting them back or trying. We did a little bit more of a pause. We gave a kind of measured, more gracious response and internalize things a bit more. I wonder what it would model for those who are watching us, whose lives we influence, and maybe for even we might even be influencing people we have no idea are watching, and potentially we could show them a better way. It might even give them hope of breaking this cycle in their own life, in their own way as well. So in this way, when we live out of this kind of forgiveness, nonviolent response and resistance, we not only set ourselves free, but we're setting others free as well. When I hear these words from Jesus now, I cannot help but think about Matthew Shepherd's mother. Do you remember a man named Matthew Shepherd and his story? Matthew Shepherd, you see, was brutally beaten for being gay because one man felt that Matthew Shepherd made a pass at him. So the man felt foolish and unmanly, and so he got a friend to help him, as he put it, put that young college student back in his place. And the two men beat Matthew Shepherd over and over again, and they tied him to a fence on a country road, and they left him alone all night in freezing temperatures. And by the time someone found Matthew Shepherd the next morning and took Matthew to the hospital, there was no way to save him. Matthew Shepherd died as hundreds stood in candlelight vigil outside the hospital praying for him. The two men who killed Matthew Shepherd were arrested. They were tried. They were convicted of this brutal hate crime, proved guilty of first-degree murder. They deserved the death penalty according to the laws in the state of Wyoming. But Matthew Shepard's mother came before the judge, and she asked the judge to spare the lives of these guilty men. Who can understand what Matthew Shepard's mother had gone through in all of these agonizing months after losing her son, after hearing it hashed and rehashed in all of the days of trial? What mother could possibly have slept well all of these days and nights with images of her beloved son being discussed for public record, of being tied to a fence, of being beaten, of being left alone and unable to be saved, dying on that hospital bed? What sort of people could do this to another human being? Jesus said, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Now, when I hear Jesus' words, I often think of Matthew Shepard's mother, her own life shaped profoundly by a gospel deeper than hatred and stronger than revenge. And I don't know that I could do what she did, but I hold Matthew Shepard's mother in my heart as a witness to the power of the gospel, which preaches forgiveness. Such kinds of love and forgiveness is not practical. It's not realistic to me from where I sit in much of my own life, but it can change the world. One of the mistakes we sometimes make with this teaching of Jesus is to imagine ourselves as some kind of a doormat over which everyone can just freely walk. But the truth is, there is nothing passive about channeling all of our strength and all of our energy towards completely redirecting a conflict instead of creating more. There is nothing wimpy about choosing the high road. In fact, it's quite the opposite. When we choose, like Matthew Shepard's mother, to resist our enemies nonviolently and to let them off the hook, when we choose to respond in a manner that does not seek to harm them back, even though they have harmed us, the way they lashed out at us, we are actually taking what amounts to a giant set of bolt cutters to the shackles known as vengeance and hatred, and we are breaking those shackles aggressively, assertively, proactively, setting ourselves and our enemies free from these chains that bind us to this endless cycle of harmful human behaviors. Now, I would argue that breaking this cycle of retribution is one of the most courageous things a human being can do in all of life. It takes almost zero courage to strike back when we're hurting, when we've been hurt. It takes tremendous courage and tremendous self-discipline and composure to choose to plot an entirely different course by the ways we react when we have legitimately been harmed. The most courageous response to someone who has hurt us is a response rather than giving back exactly what we've been given that sets a completely different kind of tone. Because violence, my friends, only begets more violence. Continuing with reactionary quarreling will occupy precious emotional energy with negativity, but courageously rising up, speaking up, and in essence saying, you did indeed hurt me, but I will not be defined by this hurt, nor will I return evil for evil, but by the grace of God, I am moving on, and so should you. Now this liberates. This empowers. This is wisdom and grace in motion. This is the way of Jesus. We may not want to live this way when it comes to loving our enemies, but friends, we need to live this way for our own good, for the good of our enemies, for the good of the whole world. Let us strive, however imperfectly, to break the cycle. Amen.